is a young president better than an old president? That's what we've come here to debate this afternoon. We've invited 70 students from 8 colleges and universities from throughout the Northwest to take part in a debate, scrimmage, and workshop at Northwest University in Kirkland. And we're so pleased that these debaters from Montana agreed to come and debate this timely topic. In the audience, we have members of the Humboldt State University debate team, and we've got the Mount Hood Community College. Anybody else out there? And some other people from the community. So we want to welcome you. I want to thank the city of Kirkland for hosting this debate and giving us the opportunity to use their fantastic facilities in the city hall here. My name's Gary Gillespie. I'm the coach at Northwest University, and we're sponsoring this scrimmage. We've invited as a guest speaker for our scrimmage one of the top international debaters in the country, Chris Kolarok from the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. So he's here. He'll be part of a panel at the end of the debate to talk about how the debaters did. What I want to do right now is introduce the speakers, explain a little bit of the rules of debate, and then we'll get into the actual arguments. Over here on the affirmative team, arguing in favor of a young president is Amy McNulty. She is a political science major from Powell, Wyoming. Her partner is Biff Griffith. He's an English major from Great Falls. The opposition is from Rocky Mountain College. And the opening opposition speaker is Allison Ridmore from Helena, Montana. She's a communication major. And Katie Burst, who's an education major from Billings. So it's Rocky Mountain College versus Carroll College, both from Montana. Immediately after the debate, we're all going to vote on who we think did the better job. So you want to put aside your partisan views and just vote on who you think did the best job, because they've been assigned their positions. So if they say something that makes you mad, just keep in mind that they're role-playing as an academic exercise. We will also have our panel of distinguished experts of debate talk about how they did. And I realize that a couple of them are going to be biased because it's the coaches of the two teams here. From Carroll College, Brent Northrup will be a panelist of among the commentators. He is the president of the Northwest Forensics Association. Then we have Shelby Jo Long from Rocky Mountain College. And then we have our guest, Chris Kolarok from Harvard. Let me tell you a little bit about the rules of debate. Students have been assigned the position. Each student will speak for about 8 minutes. Then each team will get about a 5-minute rebuttal. After the first minute of each speech, you're going to hear a knock, and that means that the other team can stand up and beg a question, just like they do in the House of Parliament. The person who has the floor can either accept the question or not, and so it's very likely that they're not going to take all the questions, just the ones they choose to take. So listen carefully as we debate this topic. Oh, and then the presiding over the House is Tiffany Dykman. She is a Northwest University debater. She'll be calling the speakers up. So let's go ahead and begin. Is a young president better than an old president? You decide.
Thank you. I call this House to order. At this time, I'd like to ask the Prime Minister to give their speech to exceed no more than 7 minutes.
All right. Well, I'd just like to start by thanking everyone for being here. Of course, all of the judges that he just talked about who are going to be commenting on this debate. Certainly our coach, Brent Northup, for all of his wisdom. And our opponents from Rocky Mountain College. It's kind of cool that we're in Washington when we could have just been doing this in Montana. But whatever. It'll be fun. And certainly my partner, Biff. And also, I just want to point out that I'm really happy that the opposition team showed up today. I heard on the news that they wanted to postpone today's debate, but it's nice nice that we're all here to do this. So let's get right into it. Resolved, a young president is better than an old president. First of all, we'd like to go ahead and make it clear what we think about this resolution. We think it's pretty clear that a young president is referring to Barack Obama and an old president is referring to John McCain. So in today's debate, my partner and I are going to tell you the reasons why Barack Obama would be a better president than John McCain. And although I myself have many, many reasons why Barack Obama would be a better president, I don't have time for them all, so I'm just going to try and do two reasons why I think Barack Obama would be a better president. The first of which is that he will strengthen the middle class. The middle class literally cannot afford McCain. They do not have enough money to do so because they have been hurt in the last 8 years. So the first thing we're going to talk about is how the middle class has been hurt by the economic policies of George Bush. What we have to understand is that the real wage income of the middle class family has actually lowered by about $2,000 in the past 8 years. So while the rich keep getting richer, they're staying stagnant or falling behind. And we think this is because of the tax cuts that are geared toward the rich that George Bush had proposed and are the Bush tax cuts. The trickle-down economics have never trickled down to the middle class or to the poor in America, and they are just benefiting the rich. This is proven by the presidencies of Bill Clinton and George Bush. When you contrast them, you see Bill Clinton geared his tax cuts toward the middle class, and the economy was booming under Bill Clinton. But George Bush, by comparison, geared them toward the upper class, and we see that they're holding onto the money, and it's not getting to the middle class. So how will Obama fix this? We have to understand that his tax policy is geared toward the middle class versus McCain's. And when Barack Obama calls McCain Bush III, that's really not giving enough credit to John McCain, because he's actually adding a few billion dollars to George Bush's high-income tax cuts. And they're geared towards the wealthy and wealthy corporations. The Cato Institute, which is a conservative institute, actually quantified the amount of money that Barack Obama and John McCain's tax policies will probably give to people in income brackets. For between like $36,000 to $66,000, Barack Obama will reduce your taxes by over $1,000, while McCain will only reduce them by $300. From $66,000 to $112,000 a year, Barack Obama will reduce your taxes by $1,300 and John McCain by only $1,000. So the choice is pretty clear that Barack Obama cares more about the middle class than John McCain. We have to understand why the middle class is important, however. And the first reason is because of the fact that they pretty much caused the financial crisis we're in right now. Because their incomes have decreased, they haven't been able to make their mortgage payments. Because they were unable to make their mortgage payments and they fell behind on their mortgages, and we had this subprime loan crisis, which has gotten all the way up to the banks that were buying these mortgages from smaller banks. We also have to see the middle class is important because they're the spenders in the economy. It's not the high class. It's not the wealthy people in America who do the majority of the spending. They save their money. They make money off of their money. It's the middle class who uses their money to buy things. So they pour money to the economy and help that sector. So the good things that we can see as a result of Barack Obama's middle class tax cuts is that, first of all, he makes the middle class bigger by helping poor people get back up into the middle class. Starting with these tax cuts, they're not going to be taking away more of the money. So this gives also people who are already in the middle class more money. And because they will have more money, it'll increase their spending. Altogether, their increased spending is going to help the economy. And it also helps the quality of life of these people. They are able to buy food. They're able to buy gas. They don't have to make those tough choices between being able to afford medicine or afford food for a month or making that mortgage payment that they may be falling behind, especially if it's an adjustable rate mortgage that keeps going up. They're able to buy these things. And it helps us get out of our current financial crisis because they are more able to afford their mortgage payment and more people are able to afford to buy a home, which could help increase the price of homes if more people are getting into them. So we have to understand that Barack Obama is better for the middle class and we can't afford John McCain for that. But we also have to see that Barack Obama can help us in another sector that John McCain couldn't, and that is in the area of national service. National service is something that has always been important to America, but in recent years, the participation in national service has been extremely low. Young people don't feel a need to serve. Our country's just all about making money, going to the best colleges to get the best jobs and to make the most money and be the most successful. But we have to show young people that there are more important things to do and you should give back. And what better way to do that than give them some money as an incentive to give them national service, which is why I think Barack Obama's plan is good, because he has proposed a $4,000 tax credit a year for college students who will commit to serving their country for a year in any of the National Service Corps, as well as doing a community service project. Yes, Alice.
If you incentivize national service to this extent, doesn't it actually go from service to a job?
We think that, as I said, it's kind of ironic that we're going to be using money as an incentive to do national service. But first of all, we think it's important to get more people into college. That's going to outweigh that. And second of all, we think that it's important to get these people doing national service. At the point where you have both of those things happening, like, that's a good thing. And hopefully when they're in national service, they will realize the importance of giving back to their community, and they can pass that on to everyone they know and people around them. So first of all, Barack Obama's giving more people an opportunity to go to college. He equalizes it more by giving this $4,000 tax credit. John McCain applauds national service, but he doesn't have a plan like this to get people involved in it. And more service helps and strengthens communities across the United States. It helps to decrease homelessness with projects like Habitat for Humanity. It helps to decrease poverty by working with welfare programs and with churches and helping people to get food and to eat and to provide for their family. It also improves the U.S. image around the world with projects like the Peace Corps. The point of the Peace Corps is to show Americans doing good work in other countries, and when they're doing good work in those other countries, it shows a good image. And we have the young people of America doing this, it can only help our country. So for these reasons, and as I stated, many more, Barack Obama would be a better president, and a young president is better than an old president. Thank you.
Thank you. At this time, I'd like to call the Leader of Opposition to give a speech to exceed no more than 8 minutes.
I also would like to begin by with a round of thank yous to our judges who have come here today, to Gary Glipsy, I'm going to kill that last name, for putting on this wonderful event. It's always a great honor to get to learn with my peers and with those more experienced than myself, and to discuss very important issues about who's going to be the best president for the coming 4 years. Right now is a very, very dire time for our country, and we need to look towards experience and leadership to bring us out of this economic turndown and the foreign mess that we have come to. And so today's debate, you're going to be voting for the person who has the best plan to minimize the amount of time we spend in these dire situations. And that is always going to be why you're going to want to vote for McCain over Barack Obama. The first thing that we need to look at here is the economic policies within the United States. Amy did a really good job of mirroring her candidate and giving you a lot of really pretty terminology and happy pictures about hope and the middle class and rescuing them and saving them. But she never gave you a specific plan. She never gave you any real plan that will lead to this, to coming out of this very dire situation. McCain, on the other hand, has a specific outline for how we're going to come out of this. The first one is the alternative minimum tax. This is a flat tax that was introduced in the 1960s. It's placed on the middle class that they have to pay if they qualify for it, regardless, with no deductions or benefits. It compromises 26 to 28% of their income. So if you make $75,000, $22,000 of that goes directly to the IRS and the federal government. No questions asked, no deductions made. This is incredibly detrimental to the middle class right now. This is a plan that Barack Obama supports very adamantly. He's voted to keep it around. Sound like somebody who's supporting the middle class? I don't think so. McCain, on the other hand, has labeled this as an A priority to get rid of in his term as presidency. He wants to abolish this so that that $22,000 stays in the hands of the middle class, where they can pay for their food, pay for their heating, pay for clothing for their children. At the point where we see Barack Obama take office, what we see is an increase of our debt because families have to pay this 30% of their income to the IRS. This decreases the revenue that they have to pay for their house, to pay their mortgage bills. At that time, we move further into the financial crisis we have because families have to take loans and mortgage their houses. This only escalates an already bad situation. We are never going to want to prefer this, and for this reason, first and foremost, you're going to reject what Amy told you in her first speech about the middle class. The second one you want to look at is the capital gains tax. The capital gains tax deals specifically with the stock market. What we see is that it is a tax given to those who have invested in the stock market on their wins or losses of that year. focus on the words wins or losses. However much money I put into the stock market, I am taxed on that, regardless if I lose my shirt or I win big. And really, who today is winning big? So at that point, what we're seeing is a further increase in our taxes, or in the amount of taxes that the middle class is paying. This hurts the middle class, and it hurts the low investors, but it also hurts the upper class specifically, because they're the ones who put huge amounts of money into diversified stocks. This props up our stock market, which is very crucial at this moment, where this morning, as anyone who picked up the Seattle Times saw that WaMu was just bought out by JP Morgan. Yeah, JP Morgan. So at that point, what we're going to need to see is that by McCain getting rid of this as soon as possible, it's one of his first priorities when he gets into office, is that we no longer are taxed on our stock market investments, and we're more willing to pump money into the stock market, which will help us get out of this plummeting downturn and swing back into a stable stock market, which is crucial for all businesses, because the stock market really is the trickle-down that Amy was talking about. If our stock market is happy, we're happy. If our stock market's sad, we're all sad. Thank you for laughing at that. I appreciate that, Amy.
Anytime, Judy.
Thanks, Beth. Our third point that we want to look at is the windfall profit taxes. Windfall profit taxes are a flat, or let me grab that. Windfall profit taxes are a tax that is done on gas and natural oil. It's aimed at oil companies and major companies within the country that deal with natural gases. Now, at face value, this looks like exactly what Amy's talking about. It's a tax break to the wealthy, and Obama doesn't want to give them that tax break. However, if we dig a little deeper, what we see is that at the point where we're taxing these major corporations, they turn around and pass that on to us. Anyone who's filled up their car recently knows that instead of paying $1.99 for gas, we're now paying $3.68 in places like Billings for a tank of gas. This is a direct correlation to this.
Okay.
At the point where Barack Obama implements the windfall tax, we're going to see an increase in our price of groceries, which is correlated to the price of gas, as well as our heat, our electricity, and our lives in general, from our clothes and what we wear. Go ahead.
Just a quick question. About how large a percent of corporations, natural gas and oil, would you say actually pay their taxes?
Actually pay their taxes?
Yeah.
Exxon paid $27 billion last year. I mean, they pay taxes.
They pay taxes. They pay income taxes. They don't pay windfall taxes because they're not in place right now.
Okay.
Obama wants to put windfall taxes as a punishment on these companies, so they would pay windfall taxes in addition to their income taxes. So basically, you're going to get taxed twice.
Okay.
And they're going to pass that on down to you. So for those reasons uniquely, McCain has outlined a plan that will help prevent us from slipping further into our economic downturn by regulating the taxes and by putting that cap on the gas companies so that they won't have that incentive to charge you even more when you fill up your car, or for the farmers to charge you more for the groceries because they had to fill up their tractors when they were working on the crops. So at that point, you're always going to want to prefer the experienced president with the plan. Once again, look at what Amy said. It's beautiful and it sounds very nice, but there's no outline and there's no plan there. So you're going to prefer the experience here and the older candidate. The next area that we're going to want to look at in today's debate is that of foreign relations, national service, as Amy put it. What we're going to see here is that in national service, most of this is empirically untrue. Right now, last year, enrollment in the voluntary services, Army, Navy, Air Force, all increased into the thousands. This is not the dire situation Amy portrayed it to be. However, what is a dire situation is that of the Iraqi war. Once again, Obama has not given us a clear-cut plan until recently, where he outlined the need for troop withdrawal, whereas McCain has outlined staying in there. This is the true national emergency that we need to be looking at, and once again, you're going to prefer this experience because at the point where we pull out of Iraq, we get into civil war. What you're going to want to vote on in today's debate is that of experience over inexperience. You're going to prefer the candidate who has outlined a plan and a procedure and has a clear-cut way to shorten the duration of our dire situation right now, because we can't afford to stay here much longer. So with that, you're going to be voting to save the middle class, and you're going to be voting for McCain. Thank you.
At this time, I'd like to call the member of government to give a speech to exceed no more than 8 minutes.
No worries.
All right, so just an extended round of thank yous to everyone, especially people who came to watch us. We don't get this a lot, so it's nice to know that we matter a little. So with that, we're going to just kind of get straight into it. And the first thing I'm going to say is we're talking about the economy, really, and I don't think it matters because John McCain said that he wasn't coming back until the economy was fixed, and he's going to the debates tonight, so we could just move on. With that, we're actually going to start off. Specifically, Katie tells you that we don't have a plan as Obama, and that's a problem because we're working with inexperience here, and we don't exactly know what we're going to be doing. But if you listened to Amy when she was speaking, she specifically said that there's going to be a major tax break coming out of the Obama camp, uniquely towards the middle class. In fact, she gives you a couple of numbers. She says that if you are in about the $36,000 to $66,000 a year tax bracket, you're going to be saving about $1,000 with Barack Obama, whereas John McCain's really going to be saving you about $300. Now, while we understand that taxing the middle class with this flat tax that exists is a problem, we also believe that giving them money back that they already don't have to pay is probably a little more of an incentive for the middle class to keep spending. So we do actually have a plan, and Obama's people have crunched the numbers, and instead of calling the nation a group of whiners, they have told us that we're actually going to allow to have money back in our pockets, that we're going to be able to move forward as a country and put money back into our own economy. They're giving us the power to do this, whereas John McCain is essentially telling us that it's time for us to suck it up. And that's not something that we really need. On this flat tax, they're telling us that there's this $75,000 tax bracket, which is where you start paying this 26 to 28%. Uniquely, $75,000 is uniquely where we come from. That's what you call upper middle class. Like, those are the people who are making enough money to actually survive, and they have the ability to pay this. But we're talking about the people who are uniquely below that. The people who are below the $75,000 who need a tax break to actually come their way, who need to be able to put money back into their mortgages. These are the people who sunk the subprime mortgage market. These are people who didn't make house payments, who have lost their homes. Like, these are the people who really need the money, and John McCain has no plan whatsoever to allow these people to have any relief. The only thing he's telling us is that if you invest in the stock market, which if I make $20,000 a year, I don't do a lot of, then that's when we have to be able to save these people right then. And she also talks about the capital gains tax and how Obama wants to reinstitute that. And that's a bit of a problem. Actually, Barack Obama, Amy and I, since we are Barack Obama together, is actually looking to move it back to what Bill Clinton instituted the capital gains tax as, which is just a little bit higher than what it currently is, but it also doesn't cause as big of a problem. If you look to Bill Clinton when he entered office, when he gave his first inaugural address, he told the American people, I'm not going to pander to you. I'm not going to tell you this is going to be easy. I'm going to tell you it's going to suck because we have to prepare our economy. We're going to have to start fighting foreign powers uniquely in things like investment. And that's essentially what Barack Obama's doing. And Bill Clinton did a pretty decent job of pulling the American economy out of the bucket, uniquely in the stock market with things like the capital gains tax. So if anything, if we're going to go off empiricals, we need to look at the capital gains tax and say we should keep it. If anything, it's going to benefit us more than it's going to harm us. And they say that John McCain wants to push a giant flush of money into the stock market. Yep, we did that. It was called the 1990s. I do believe we called it the dot-com bubble, and it popped. And as soon as it popped, we actually saw major problems within the United States. So if we really want to start pushing money back into the economy, we should do it in a way when the American people have the ability to slowly put it back into what they want to do, to put it in things like their mortgages, into things like food, into things like gas, where we can start to stimulate it little by little instead of making a giant bubble, which then we all lose. And then she talks about these windfall profit taxes, and I'm too short for this. These windfall profit taxes on gas and natural oil and how they're going to pass the price on to us. Again, it happened. Like, I don't drive a lot because Helen is kind of a small community, and I drive a Toyota Corolla, so it's like $25 to fill my tank. But I went up to like $34, and I'm already paying this much for gas. And if the oil and people stopped buying gas when it got too high, so really, it's not making a lot of sense that these companies are going to keep jacking the price of gas up as high as they can. Like, supply and demand does check back every now and then, even on people like the oil companies. And secondly, like, Amy and I tell you that 11%, like, total, I don't care if Exxon's paying $26 billion, 11% of companies in the United States total with gas pay their taxes. So, I mean, really, if anything, we should be taxing them more. Let's tax them twice and make it like a kind of 22% that we're taxing out of this 11%. Let's get some money back from these people. Like, yeah, I'm sorry Sarah Palin wants to protect them, but I don't care. I want money back in my economy. Yes.
Does it make sense to punish companies that are already paying their taxes by taxing them more?
Sure. Like, if no one else wants to pay their taxes and we really want to make a point that we're going to start taxing you and we're going to make you pay, let's enforce it. Like, let's make a tax that we have to do. And that's what Barack Obama says. He says we need to check back on these oil companies and make sure that kind of thing happens. So essentially what we're telling you is that Katie and Allison really want you to prefer the experience, and John McCain with the experienced president, yet he hasn't been elected. And we want to do things like this, but we're telling you that everything, if you want experience and you want things that are going to allow things to get better and are empirically proven to let things get better, that's what Barack Obama is essentially giving us. He's giving us definite plans, ideas that have been tried and tested true and have helped the American economy before, and something else that we need to do. Okay, so taxing the oil companies and making them pay is something brand new, but making people pay their taxes is something the IRS is pretty good at, and if we allow that to happen, we can actually see a flush of money into our economy at a steady, stable rate that allows the American people to have a hand in saving their own butts like they did with Bill Clinton instead of just letting the government bail them out again. So with that, we're going to go to the national service point that we've been talking about. Katie really didn't get to bring this up, but Allison did ask the question, and there was some knocking, so I think I'll deal with it, about how, why should we pay people to do national service, because doesn't that make it a job? Uniquely right now, like, Amy and I really don't see a problem with that. Like, why don't we call it a job then? Like, why don't we get people involved in helping our communities? We don't see the problem with changing the name of that. Right now, if you work for AmeriCorps in a legal services opportunity, like, you get the AmeriCorps wages and food stamps, but we also incentivize you by paying off your student loans. Like, essentially, we're paying people to get into that field, and they're still doing wonderful things for people who can't afford legal representation. So if anything, we're saying, yeah, let's incentivize people to get back into that. And Katie says the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force are doing great with recruitment and things like that. Good. Like, we understand that we do need people in those, that we are overstretched as the United States military, but we also understand that we need people in our national service places, like Habitat for Humanity, like soup kitchens, like places and communities where we can make things like that better, where we can increase people's involvement to their own homes instead of foreign countries. Like, we want to keep people in the United States so they can help out their own communities first, and that's what this incentive program actually allows us to do. And then Katie starts to talk about the Iraqi war and how if we pull out, it's going to be a problem. We're going to say that, one, Barack Obama has actually given us a definite plan for pulling out of the Iraqi war, and uniquely he said that we need to start pulling out because, as we've seen before, the Iraqi government really doesn't do anything unless we threaten them that we're not going to be there to prop them up anymore. Like George Bush said, we're pulling out, the Iraqi government started to work. He said, oh, wait, we're kidding. We want to stay because it's kind of fun, and it didn't actually happen. Thank you.
At this time, I'd like to call the member of opposition to give a speech to exceed no more than 8 minutes.
All right. I'd like to start off by thanking everyone here as well. Peanut Gallery, you guys are definitely appreciated. It's really nice to see some butts in the chairs for a change. Judges, opponents, and my lovely partner, Katie. With that, I'm going to go ahead and get into these issues because I think they're pretty heavy issues and they're going to take some time for me to talk about. What I'm going to do is go through some of Biff's responses and talk about how, like, they're really not true in today's debate and why you're always going to want to prefer McCain over Obama. Biff tells us that on economic policies on the alternative minimum tax, he tells us that poor people need money more and that McCain doesn't provide relief for lower class people and that the alternative minimum tax really just taxes people who are middle class and upper middle class. Well, I've got news. The subprime mortgage crisis was actually caused by people in the middle class and the upper middle class who were incapable of paying their mortgage because, like, they didn't have the money to do that. So when you take a family that earns $75,000 a year and you take $22,000 away from them like that, they can no longer pay their loans. This is going to explode the subprime mortgage crisis, and what you're going to see is companies like WaMu and companies like pretty much every bank you can imagine is going to shut down, and the economy is going to go into this downward spiral that it's going to be impossible for us to pull out of. That's what you do when you vote for Obama. When you vote for McCain, you see someone who's going to treat the economy responsibly, who has the experience to understand it, and who is going to do the right thing here by getting rid of the alternative minimum tax. He also says that, you know, they do have a plan. They've got these tax breaks for middle class and lower income people. What I'm going to tell you is that they are robbing Peter to pay Paul. What they're doing is they're increasing the cost of gas, they're increasing the cost of groceries, and then they're saying, oh, but here's $1,000 back. The average family is going to spend way more on their increased gas in 1 year than that tax break is going to be able
able to pay for, but beyond which, they're going to send the economy into a downward spiral by doing that because consumer confidence is tied to gas prices. When people see gas prices skyrocket, they stop buying stuff. And that's when you see the economy take a serious downward turn that we just can't pull out of. People lose their jobs, people like can't get work anymore, and that's going to be really bad. And that's what you do when you vote for Obama. What's up, Amy?
I'm just wondering how you made the jump from we're giving a middle class tax break to we're increasing food prices.
That was with the alternative, or that was with windfall profit taxes, excuse me. Like, Katie already told you about how windfall profit taxes make, basically make oil companies charge more for gas, right? So when oil companies are charging more for gas, that tax break that they give is never going to offset that. Okay, the next response Biff gives us is that on the capital gains tax, he says that Bill Clinton only increased it a tiny little bit, and that's not going to be a big deal. I'm going to tell you what happened during Bill Clinton's administration. He increased it from 15% to 28%. That's a huge jump. When that happens, people don't want to invest anymore. This is empirically proven. When Bill Clinton raised the taxes that high, people stopped investing and they actually lost revenue. They increased the tax, they lost revenue for the government. That's exactly what's going to happen this time. People are going to stop investing, they're going to tank the stock market, and they're actually going to make less money on the tax. So this policy just doesn't make sense. John McCain's policy of keeping the 15% capital gains tax makes sense. It means that people continue to invest and people try to pull the market out of the downward spiral it's on now. You're always going to want to prefer that over this policy that gets us less revenue and a downward spiral on the market. Yes, Amy?
Doesn't the dot-com boom show that capital gains taxes don't harm investing in the stock market?
I was just about to get to that, actually. I'm going to tell you that the dot-com boom was caused by Bill Clinton's policy, right? Like, we saw the dot-com boom in 2000 coming out of Bill Clinton's economic policies. This is, like, there's no way you can really tie this to Bush policy. So what I'm going to tell you is raising the capital gains tax is just never going to happen. They don't have any specific analysis to prove that that's true. Furthermore, they talk about how we need to put this money back in slowly. What I'm going to tell you is that Obama doesn't do that. Obama actually taxes wealthy people at, like, the biggest tax hike in modern American history. So when you give them that amount of tax hike, you're not throwing money back into the market slowly. You're doing it like that. And you're actually incentivizing wealthy people to stop investing, which means that, again, downward spiral, the market crashes. That's really bad. Biff's next response is that, well, gas is on the windfall profit taxes. He talks about how gas is already expensive and supply and demand is going to make it so that gas prices aren't going to get any more expensive. I'm going to say that this isn't true for a special and unique reason. The CEOs of Exxon and the CEOs of Conoco have actually come out and said, if we get a windfall profit tax, we're just going to pass it along to the consumer. What that means is that you can almost guarantee that as soon as the windfall profit tax passes, which it will under Barack Obama, there's going to be a sudden and arbitrary increase in the cost of gas. And by association, whenever gas goes up, groceries go up. So at the end of the day, when you elect Barack Obama, you're going to see this huge increase in taxes, you're going to see a huge increase in taxes for the wealthy, a huge increase in the cost of gas, a huge increase in the cost of groceries, and the answer that this equation makes is a downward spiral for the economy. And if you guys picked up a newspaper this morning, you saw that Washington Mutual failed. Like, we're already in one of the worst downward spirals that we've ever seen, and Barack Obama's policies make these worse because, contrary to popular belief, they actually punish the poor in the middle class by jacking up costs like gas and groceries and by the alternative minimum tax, which taxes upper middle class people who are already having trouble paying their mortgages. But with that, I think we need to set the economy aside for a second and talk about some of the points that were made on national service and some of the points that were made about Iraq. Although they were brief, I would sort of like to fill them out a little bit. Biff says that
Okay. On national service, he says that the national service really should be a job and that we should incentivize people to join. I'm going to say that this already happens right now. I'm getting ready to go into the Peace Corps, like myself personally. They're actually going to set aside my student loans for that for the period of my service so that I don't have to pay any taxes on them. I don't have to pay any interest. That's all, you know, gravy for me. They also give me $6,000 as soon as I get out, and I can pretty much go anywhere I want to grad school for free. So as you can see, there are already a lot of incentives for this. Like, if we incentivize it anymore, it actually becomes better for us to go in the national service than to go get a job. And I'm going to say that, like, that's sort of bad, especially at the point that, like, we need people working right now in order to pull us out of the economic crisis. But furthermore, it's already happening in the status quo. You guys should really vote to improve the economy overall. Like, furthermore, he says that Obama's plan is to pull out of Iraq. I'm going to tell you that this is uniquely bad because we're the only people who are keeping them from going into all-out civil war. When they go into all-out civil war, what's going to happen is hundreds of thousands of people are going to die. So, like, please don't vote for Obama to just completely pull out of Iraq and let those people die. So at the end of the day, what you see is that McCain's experience keeps the economy in better shape. It keeps us in better shape in Iraq. And you're always going to want to prefer that and vote for McCain. Thank you.
At this time, I'd like to call the opposition closing speaker to give closing rebuttal speech to exceed no more than 4 minutes.
Once again, thank you to everyone who came out and watched this today. It's such a wonderful way to start the weekend, isn't it? Talking about all the ways that life is sucking at the moment. Just for your perspective, how bad do you really need that second beer on Friday night? So with that, right now we have a tale of two cities of great woe. We have the worst of times and the worst of times. So what are we voting for? We're voting for who is best going to shorten the time that we spend in this awfulness. We're voting for the person who will best lead us into a world where we can't afford a second beer on a Friday night. And with that, we're going to go to reasons why you're going to always want to vote for McCain for the economic upturn. First of all, look at what I told you in my first speech about Amy and Biff's plan and about how their endorsements for Obama specifically never lay out any groundwork for how they give you that money back. You never get anything except for words and warm, fuzzy feelings. And while warm, fuzzy feelings are very happy at a movie or in a book, they're not something you want when you're looking at economic policy. What we want when we look at economic policies are a clear-cut way to our future and to how we are going to get out of these dire situations. Look to specifically what we told you about the alternative minimum tax, about how this is affecting the middle class, and how at that point our mortgage crisis increases, we continue our downward spiral, and how this ends up being 30% of most middle class families' income. This is money that's not going towards food or food or mortgages, towards heating our houses or buying clothes for our children. Next off, look at the response Allison gives you about how the tax breaks are robbing Peter to pay Paul, and how this doesn't check back what we tell you about windfall taxes, which is the next thing you want to look at. Filling up your car, especially if you happen to live in a place that isn't as small as Helena or Billings, where fortunately we can walk most places except in the winter when it becomes very cold, isn't always that simple. Oftentimes people in LA and Seattle have to rely on cars and transportation. At this point, there's no way of getting around the fact that I need to go to Exxon or Conoco and fill up my car. At the point where we elect Obama and we have these windfall profit taxes, I'm looking at paying $8, $9 to fill up my car instead of paying the atrocious $3. At that point, this tax break that they tell you in their first speech simply doesn't give you enough. It doesn't give you that assurance that we can get out of this. The next point that you need to look at is the capital gains tax. Look at what we tell you about the major corporations, about how they are what props up our stock markets, which is what props up our small businesses. We're all interconnected, and at the point where we begin punishing those at the top, we begin punishing everyone because it all trickles down. the point that our stock market plummets, we lose this revenue. Also, look to the empirics she gives you about the Clinton administration. At the point where Clinton upped it from 15% to 28%, we saw a flat line, and we actually saw the loss of revenue. So for all of those reasons, right there, you're going to be preferring the McCain policies over the Obama policies in today's debate, because it gives you a set procedure for how we get out of this economic downturn and back to buying beer on Friday nights. Was that my time? Okay. Thank you for that. So for those reasons, you're going to be preferring McCain. Thank you.
This time I'd like to call the government closing speaker to give a closing rebuttal speech to exceed no more than 5 minutes.
All right, I'd just like to thank everybody once again for what I think has been a good debate. And in this speech, I just want to kind of crystallize why I think we've won this debate and why Barack Obama would be a better president. But first, onto that beer point she was making. We're both underage, so I just think that that's unfair. It kind of shuts us out of the debate. But anyway, what we have to see is that when they talk about how John McCain is an experienced leader and he has a plan for everything and Barack Obama doesn't have a plan, I feel like they're just fundamentally ignoring us and fundamentally ignoring Barack Obama's plans, because we've been giving you specific plans and they haven't been giving you specific plans of McCain's. And to better illustrate that, I'm going to go through on our economy point and show you what they talked about. We gave you a specific plan, his middle class tax cut. They gave you a bunch of reasons why that might not be good. Let's go through them. First of all, they talked about the flat tax. The first thing I'd like to say on this is, in Barack Obama's plan, he doesn't increase this. Secondly, John McCain does not get rid of it in his tax plan. So at the point where their candidate, the one that they are saying that you should vote for, doesn't get rid of this flat tax and the middle class gets this money taken away from them no matter what, that doesn't make John McCain a better president. And then onto the capital gains tax that they talk about. They say that no one will want to invest in the stock market or in America if we increase this tax. But then they grant us the fact that the dot-com boom happened. So the capital gain taxes were high under Bill Clinton's administration, and people were investing in the stock market like it was nobody's business, like everybody was going into the stock market. And we see that with the economy having a boom under Bill Clinton, this shows that the capital gains tax doesn't do this. We told you how Barack Obama is simply returning the capital gains tax to what it was under Bill Clinton. The economy was good then, it'll be good now. Then they talk about how he'll increase taxes on the wealthy. I don't know about all of you, but I don't make $250,000 a year. Does anybody in this room make $250,000 a year? If you do, more power to you. But the fact of the matter is these people have been getting away with murder the past 8 years, and they've gotten huge tax breaks. And if we just return to the way it was under the Bill Clinton administration and we are taxing them at a higher rate, it helps our middle class, which helps the economy as a whole. I told you in the beginning of this speech about at the beginning of this debate about how the middle class is fundamental to the economy. Everything they do ties into the economy because they are the spenders. They're the one doing the transactions in the economy. And so if we need to tax the upper class, like, what's the worst thing that can happen? They can't buy an extra Porsche next year? Like, I'm sorry, but they've gotten away with everything, and now it's time to tax them. Then they talk about the windfall profit taxes and how that's going to cause oil prices and food prices to rise, but they ignore our argument against that, where we tell you that supply and demand would check that back. We showed you about how gas prices were at their highest this summer in July. They were $4.10 a gallon nationwide or something. People stopped driving. Like, there was a total decrease in demand. People started taking public transportation. They started carpooling. They started buying hybrid cars. Like, there was a huge drop in demand, and at that point, prices fell. In Helena right now, prices are 362. Like, they're much lower than they were this summer because demand went down. So that always checks it back. The windfall profit taxes don't increase prices forever. But further, they fundamentally ignore the point that we make that Barack Obama actually helps the middle class. He is the one giving them a bigger tax break. We actually gave you numbers. How much more specific can we get for you? Barack Obama has a clear plan to help the middle tax. At the point where he helps the middle class, he helps the whole economy, and that's important. But I also think that the national service is an important point. And I applaud Allison for going into the Peace Corps. But not all young people are going into national service opportunities like she is. And we need more of them. Their basic argument against this is that we will be incentivizing this too much. Well, God forbid we could be incentivizing something that could help our country in our country and around the world. Like, What's wrong with that? They didn't tell us what was wrong with incentivizing this. At the point where we're getting more people an opportunity to go to college by giving them $4,000 a year for every year that they commit to national service, and we're getting more service by helping strengthening the communities around the United States and helping with homelessness and poverty, and we're improving our image around the world. Like, those are important things that could happen as a result of national service, and they just tell you that we shouldn't incentivize it this much, but we say it's a good thing. It's a win-win either way. Then they talk about the Iraq War and how Barack Obama will pull out and cause a civil war. But we think Barack Obama's plan is better because he puts pressure on the political leaders in Iraq. At the point where he's putting pressure on them, they will be more inclined to take over their country and beef up security. John McCain will be there forever. Why do they have to worry? Why do they have to take over their country? Barack Obama will not let Iraq devolve into civil war. He said that he'd go back. So don't listen to them saying that we're going to cost hundreds of thousands of lives. Barack Obama has a plan on Iraq. He has a plan for national service, and he has a plan on the economy. So maybe we should just stop accepting that John McCain, just because he's older, has clearer plans. Young people have ideas too, and we should get young people involved in national service, and we should elect a young president, Barack Obama. And for those reasons, he would be a better president. Thank you.
Okay, now we have that point in the debate where we can have the audience judge by applause. So vote on who you think did the better job by your applause.
Judge.
Sounds to me like the opposition team won the debate, so congratulations.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
But now we can listen to our panel just talk generally about what they observe.
All right. I'm going to start off by saying that my approach to debate is very different from what we saw here today. What we saw here today was a modeling of NPDA, which I haven't done in about 4 years. But I figure it's okay since this is a teaching weekend for many of you on what world-style debate and what judges would expect or comment on. If this had been a British parliamentary debate. So first, let me say, generally, debates are more interesting and people will pay attention if there's a lot more interaction. So in this debate, the debaters here and audience members, don't be afraid to rise to points of information. Get up and ask when something sounds suspicious to you. Rise to a point of information, because that's probably a visual cue to a judge that something is wrong, and a judge might actually be agreeing with you. Also, even if the judge doesn't know what's going on, it's just more interesting to see activity there rather than people continuing to talk and talk and talk. With that out of the way, I think that there is also a lot of, in this debate, there was also a lot of things of, like, claiming that things were just good because we all agreed that they were good. Like, the idea of national service, increasing participation in national service is just good in itself. In British parliamentary debate, actually, it should be in any debate in general, everyone should enter tabula rasa, or value neutral, and just saying that something is good because it's national service, that shouldn't trigger something in your mind to warm, fuzzy feelings about Peace Corps volunteers. Debaters should work toward telling you why it's good, why they are saying it, and what's the unique advantage of doing what they're talking about. So don't rely and don't rest on the laurels of the words you're using. Actually work to explain and prove to me what's going on. I would also... This is just an issue. Word choice. We heard a lot of the phrase natural oil coming out. I don't know what non-natural oil is, but we might have been conflating crude oil and natural gas in there.
That was a word switch from Katie. Actually, she meant to say oil and natural gas, but she said gas and natural oil.
as I suspected. Additionally, there was discussion about Washington Mutual failing. What does failure mean? Because Washington Mutual, in the classic sense of a bank, all the depositors are going to get their cash. So what does it mean to fail? Does it mean that they're just no longer an independent company and they're owned by JPMorgan Chase? Or does it mean, like the bank in California, IndyMac, that some people have to wait up to a year to get some of their cash back, if they get it all back? So we need to... explain the words that you're using that pass judgment on things that are happening. The word failure obviously has impact on your economic argument, and so you need to explain to me, what does that mean? Third, I would say that there's an issue of of speed. In a world-style context, speed is something that is it can be useful, but it's also something that you need to keep track of. Remember, this world-style debate generally tries to model what would happen in Parliament, and so you have to ask yourself, would I be giving this speech standing up in front of a bunch of surly Englishmen who are surely going to make fun of me if I sound like a robot? Probably not. Try aiming for more pauses, less words that, I mean, have more impact. Number four, I think there's an issue we have to remember about credibility. Now, one of the things that was happening in this debate is the resolution, the motion, was known for a while. But we had some issues about talking about subprime mortgages. If you're going to broach a subject, I think it's important for you to know what's going on there. We had the idea that subprime mortgages and the financial crisis were brought on because of taxes. Well, that's not actually, from my understanding, that's not quite right. There's an issue of the subprime mortgage market had an issue, main problems of adjustable rate mortgages, that when times were good, when times were bad, interest rates, prime rates, the federal funds rates was low, and so the market, the interest rate that banks charged individuals was naturally low. Additionally, these adjustable rate mortgages, even in times of flat interest rates, were going to rise. So what we had is unscrupulous lenders combined with ignorant people on how to take out a mortgage and what they could afford. No matter what was going to happen, people were going to have higher house payments. That combined with the issue of what are called liar loans, people who got loans without having to prove that they had an income. So you could get a $700,000 loan without proving you could pay for it. Naturally, those went into default. Combined with speculation and combined with loans that were zeroed down, and the issue of overexposure. I mean, Washington Mutual is losing $30 billion on its subprime portfolio. That's how large this was. To call it an issue of taxes, that because people were taxed, they couldn't afford to pay their mortgage, and that brought out the subprime mortgage crisis. What that does is it robs someone of credibility. And in this situation, they didn't need to talk about that. They broach the subject, it's upon them to prove it. And if I know as a judge that what they're saying is not correct, their credibility is just shot, and it's very difficult for me to listen further. But with that, let's move on. One of the things that was very, very, very good to hear was an issue of a criteria or a thesis. It's difficult to judge a debate with only two teams in it, but add that where in the world context there are four teams in a debate without some kind of thesis or without a criteria on which I turn. Now, the first team did not offer necessarily a very strong criteria or one that I was able to pick out, but the second team, the opposition, stated very clearly, whoever wins this debate is the ones who prove that we are in a recession the shortest amount of time. That allows me to put every argument in context. It's a standard by which I can objectively say this team, I would vote for John McCain because I believe he keeps us in recession lower. And by the way, I have no idea who I'm voting for, so don't try to tease out any kind of political affiliation there. Reasonability of arguments, I think, was also an issue. I think at the last part we heard the windfall profit taxes would make our gas prices go up to $8 or $9 a gallon versus the current $3 issue. Well, I mean, essentially it's another thing about credibility here. I mean, the impact and power of that argument is taken away by because I'm distracted by saying, are they actually going to go up to $8 a gallon? I don't think so. And then that's the amount of time I didn't write on my paper and was not listening to the speaker. So be reasonable in what you're saying.
Chris, we need to go on to that. All right.
Sorry about that. I went too far. I'll yield.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Well, I'm glad to be here, too. It's a pleasure to have two Montana teams
We should have brought our state flag. If there was any, if there was any fairness at all, there would have been a Montana state flag back behind the...
Or at least a shotgun.
That's right. When we have my horse out front, it took us a long time to get here, too. I would offer some overview. First of all, we are at the moment a traditional parley program considering worlds. I come from a perspective of traditional parley, and I would offer some context for those that aren't watching the evolution of college debate, but for those students who were in it, Humboldt and I had a conversation a minute ago, they know all about this, that it evolution inside parliamentary debate. Right now the buzzwords are there's traditional parley and progressive parley. And traditional parley is pretty much what you saw today. Some of the characteristics of traditional parley include, oh my gosh, suits, standing up while they speak, respectful behavior, and general public decorum. That used to be the norm. It's not necessarily the norm. There are students sitting down, not dressed, with different norms of behavior, the argument being that it's the arguments alone that should suffice in the world rather than the rhetorical appearance of the arguments. While I'm a 60s boy who understands what it means to reject artificial layers of society, I still think that it's quite pleasant to have a public forum with traditional public rhetoric. And I think you saw the traditional values here, which are in fact losing ground rapidly in collegiate parliamentary debate. And the reason this workshop's here and the reasons Chris has been invited and we came all the way from Montana is because the evolution towards the progressive style of faster delivery and a completely different decorum is not particularly what I want to coach or reward in the program at Carroll College in Montana. So that's changing the nature of what we do, and I would like to put this in the context of a more traditional parley round, and for that I'm thankful. There were no sock puppets, and there were lots of other... we've had debates in which people brought out sock puppets. We had a famous one, which my team was thrown out of a tournament for participating in a sock puppet round, and I just shook my head and said, why did you do that? And they said, oh, we couldn't resist. It was so much fun. They were puppets. And I said, well, okay, live and learn. Hope you enjoyed the hotel for the rest of the afternoon. And but the fact remains that there are lots of argumentation. And one of the other things that happened today that I don't underestimate, that we talked about Obama and McCain in a debate that said we're going to talk about Obama and McCain. The nice thing about worlds is that topicality pretty much disappears, and we actually talk about the arguments that were suggested. And in this round, they actually talked about the arguments that were suggested, although... I mean, our team gave some thought to president of what, or this house, it was like, could we go in an unusual direction just because it would be more fun to harass our Billings friends? But we decided, no, that wouldn't be appropriate. We're going to talk about what we're supposed to talk about, which is Obama versus McCain. And that, too, is traditional, which is not always the case in modern parliamentary debate. So for all of these reasons, I think you saw traditional teams, all of which I admire for the fact that they're on point, well-dressed, in decorum, good sense of humor. All of this is what I admire in public debate. In terms of the actual argumentation of the round, I thought it started off well. It's kind of, as he says, the criteria is a little loose. They ran it kind of as a general observations one and two. I felt like they did lay out some plans at the beginning, and national service was somewhat defined at the beginning. And then there wasn't as much specific response to each of those points as went along. If you were to use lingo, I'd say the line-by-line got a little sloppy in parliamentary, which is arguments got lost, new arguments were addressed, some of the opposition points were they had to decide exactly where to apply them, and they were introducing some elements of the Obama plan that weren't initially discussed by the Obama team. They were saying, don't forget this is also part of your program. And in traditional debate, you would keep yourself fairly tightly tuned to the actual arguments of the initial presentation without introducing new ground in the second. And then as we went along, I thought Allison's was a pretty good speech in which she introduces arguments like the upper middle class had a part in the subprime. That was a good observation that was I think, overgeneralized before. And as it came down to rebuttals, another thing we saw in rebuttals that I appreciate is there was a little bit more overview, a little bit more wrapping up, a little bit more attempt to persuade at the end than you see in a lot of modern parliamentary debate, which is high speed, line by line, and no summation, no consensus thinking. So both teams, I think, were trying to give us somewhere to go in a two worlds kind of scenario. I like the beginning of the opposition rebuttal, which gave us a framework for looking at how we're going to balance the world and if which of these worlds. I also liked, as Chris did, that we have a framework for which gets us out of it faster. And then it ends on a note. I liked Amy's last speech. Of course, she's from my world, but I liked Amy's last speech. I thought she pulled it together very nicely, was attempting to give us an overview, and was attempting to come back to some of the initial arguments in her initial speech that she rightly felt, I thought, had been lost along the way, and she was reminding us where we all started. In good parliamentary debate, we try to keep on track, so to speak, of the arguments that came. So I thought it was a good, respectable example of traditional parley in a time when these kinds of rounds are of diminishing frequency. And for that, I'm grateful, and all the teams. So is there a question?
Yes, I have a topicality question. Did the opposition team have to prove that John McCain would be a better president because the revolution was a younger president would be better than an older president? Could they have said Ron Paul would be a better president or Mike Rubell would be a better president? Did they have to take the government's
definition
of they were McCain and we are Barack Obama?
Well, you better sum up the question.
So. Yeah, the simple answer to that is that they took a friendly route, which was both teams assumed. We were talking about Obama versus McCain. Lots of teams could complicate it by saying that the language invites other interpretations, and then the rhetoric would become part of the debate. And if we're going to debate the language and the rhetoric of the topic, that's a kind of debate that annoys me more often than pleases me. In this case, they just both agreed it's Barack and it's McCain. And I think there are ways that linguistic rhetoric could challenge interpretations like that, but both teams tried to keep it simple and obvious. And I appreciate that. So I'm pleased with the kind of debate that we have. If I had them around for a while, I'd give them a two-hour critique and both teams get better, because that's what we do. But I liked what I heard in terms of respectful oratory by people who stayed on topic, and I think the public is better for the discussion we had today, and that's ultimately what we like to see in debate.
My turn? All right. First of all, just to kind of give some background about myself, is that the apple does not really fall that far from the tree. I was Brent's student back when I started debate, which I don't really think was that long ago, 1995. But really, in that span of time from 1994, I think, was the first NPDA in the U.S. at Colorado College, and it's not that long ago. I mean, or otherwise I'm getting old. But in the span of the 14 years that has been, the community has just transitioned so much, and I am in the same spot that Brent is with his program as a new director at Rocky Mountain College and the young program that we have, that I don't really know if I want to compete in that region anymore or in that respectable activity anymore, and I'm excited to try this new activity. And another thing about my background is that I experienced parliamentary debate, policy debate at Carroll College. I also debated in Ireland at Trinity College. I judged at Worlds a couple of times in Glasgow and Toronto. I've been a coach for 9 years, I think, is where I'm at. So I've been at Rocky Mountain for two, or this is my third year at Rocky Mountain College. And to also preface my critique of this debate, and that Alice and Katie were very, very nervous that the judge that they did not want in the back of the room was going to comment on their debate, and that's me, because they have me comment on their debates all the time. But it was a treat to watch the two, our friends from Carroll College that are definitely by our sides at every tournament and that have definitely served as mentors to us with Brent and his coaching and the team in general, and we just really appreciate everything, and we like being part of a very friendly community. So that will preface my approach to this round. I thought it was a great round. I thought it was very enjoyable. I teach argumentation, and I love teaching argumentation because I think it opens up worlds to students that they don't initially think about, because it gives you a more critical analysis of issues. It helps you formulate arguments better. You actually learn how to warrant arguments and connect claims to your support and your backing, and I think that's such an awesome thing to see, because it's like a light bulb goes on above the head. And I think that's great. But what I did think about this round particularly, and I'm going to focus my criticism on the arguments in the round, is that it kind of seemed a little bit like an impromptu round to me. In that two-point impromptu rounds that focused a lot on one issue, but then kind of forgot the other issues. So we talked a lot about the economy, and I've been listening to Allison and Katie talk about McCain's policies begrudgingly for the past week, and it's actually been a really good experience for us to really dig deep and get into McCain's policies and to compare them to Obama's policies. And I thought the economic information in this round was fantastic, and I applaud both teams for doing all the research that they did for that. However, there were some of the round that was kind of missed, and I think some that could have really played a really important role in the bigger picture of the round with the National Service and with Iraq. And I just don't think that those two issues were really adequately warranted to be able to serve in a discussion about that. So essentially, it did come down to the economy, and I think that that's fabulous because we're kind of in a crisis. So I'm glad that we had a good exploration of that. However, I think the other two issues were also really important. So in the big picture, I think I probably would have encouraged both teams to maybe focus a little bit more on that. Allison, you had an answer in your speech that I thought was great. And Katie, I don't know if you kind of missed your time or what happened in your rebuttal. But I really wanted you to expand on it, and that's the coach and me saying that, but talking about how incentivizing these programs can be bad because people are going to not go to work. They're going to go into the Peace Corps, and we need the workers to help our economy out. We need people to be in our economy working, and I thought that was a great response, and unfortunately, because it was a I guess, one-pronged debate, we ended up not exploring those. So, I mean, but, you know, we got to explore the economy, which we all love to talk about, and it's very fun. So I thought there were some great arguments, just maybe not all engaged the way that I would have liked to see them engage. But the other comment I wanted to make before Gary cuts me off, because I tend to talk a lot, is that I think on the debate about the economy, the one thing, and coming from a policy debate background and a parliamentary debate background and judging in the MPDA for so many years and participating, we tend to have this tendency to answer big arguments with one example and not really explain how that defeats argument or even how it competes with the argument. So, for example, the dot-com crash in the early 90s, I think that's a great empiric, but I don't really understand from the government team how that engages with the larger argument of what's going to happen with the capital gains taxes. So I think we tend to look to one answer that maybe wasn't expanded on enough by the other team and not really engaged with how that defeats the entire argument. So for future, as we are both going into the world debate realm, I think that's more important, is to be able to provide the reasonable argument and to provide that we have to do that extra step to make those small examples answers and part of that bigger picture, because that's the world that we're going into. But other than that, I thought it was fantastic. I am very, very proud to be Allison and Katie's coach right now, and I'm also very, very proud to see how Biff and Amy have developed into amazing speakers over the past couple of years. So thank you for the debate.
Good. So excellent comments from our panel. We've got to see a traditional parliamentary debate round, and then at 3:30 on our campus at Northwest University, we're going to hear a world-style debate, which they've been talking about. And here we have four teams, two government and two opposition teams. They do it a little bit differently. So if you're hearing this, you might get up on that campus and see it. You can also Google my name, Gary Gillespie, Northwest, and you can get all the debate links that you want and the links to those videos. Thanks, everyone. That concludes our debate.